Now 5 p.m.
Hello and welcome to Max Politics. This is Ben Max from Gotham Gazette here on WBAI Radio 99.5 FM and WBAI.org. Thanks very much for tuning in here for the show. It's Wednesday, June 22nd, 2022. We are in the midst of early voting in the June primaries. Now, there will be some other primaries coming up in August. We have split primaries this year after there was a reprieve from that type of practice in the past couple of years. We've returned to it this year because of the mess around redistricting and some court orders. So we have primaries this month, Republican primaries, Democratic primaries for statewide offices, for the state assembly and some other local offices. In August, there will be party primaries for the state Senate and the U.S. House of Representatives. And then, of course, the general election for all of these seats coming up in the fall. So right now, here in June, we have primaries going on. The most watched primaries are for the Democratic nomination for governor, the Republican nomination for governor, the Democratic nomination for lieutenant governor. There's no competitive Republican primary for lieutenant governor. Those are the statewide seats with the real primaries. Then we have a variety of state assembly primaries, virtually all of them on the Democratic side that are pretty interesting. There's some incumbents being challenged by some insurgent progressives that are pretty interesting. There's some open seats that are interesting. So there's a bunch of assembly races to look out for. We have a rundown at GothamGazette.com under a races to watch piece. And if you look for that, you'll see a rundown of some of the assembly races that we think are somewhat to very interesting, as well as the statewide races I mentioned, the Republican gubernatorial primary among four candidates, the Democratic gubernatorial primary among three candidates, and the Democratic lieutenant governor primary among three candidates. So it's pretty interesting. It's crunch time. We're in the midst of early voting now. That goes through Sunday. Then there's a day of no voting on Monday. And then primary day is Tuesday, June 28th. There's also absentee balloting going on. So if you are a registered Democrat or Republican in New York, you can vote in the primaries and you should cast your ballot, especially in these races for governor, lieutenant governor, and state assembly. And then there's some other local party races and judicial races to check out. So speaking of the race for governor, today on the show, you're about to hear a portion of my conversation from just a little while ago with one of the candidates for governor, Jumaane Williams, the New York City public advocate who's running in the Democratic primary for governor here against Governor Kathy Hochul and against Representative Tom Suozzi. We had Representative Suozzi on the show last month. Governor Hochul's team has not responded to our invitation for an interview, a couple of invitations, in fact, but maybe I'll catch her at some point here, either before the primary or maybe during the general election, if she advances in the primary. But one of my guests today, Jumaane Williams, is trying to make sure that doesn't happen. And he wants to be the Democratic nominee. Of course, Jumaane Williams and Kathy Hochul faced off in the 2018 primary for lieutenant governor when Hochul prevailed by a fairly narrow margin. And Williams impressed a lot of people with that run and then was able to become a public advocate shortly after that in the special election that occurred when Letitia James went from public advocate to attorney general. Now, fast forward, of course, Governor Hochul ascends to the governor's office after the resignation of Governor Andrew Cuomo. And Jumaane Williams, who clearly had been considering a run against Cuomo in the primary, winds up still declaring and running against Hochul, who has obviously not been elected to the position of governor, even though she holds that office. And Tom Suozzi, who ran for governor way back in 2006, also jumped into the race. So you have this three-way race where Suozzi clearly has wanted to be governor for a long time. He's spent a bunch of time in other offices since then, including in Congress here. He's giving up that seat to run in the Democratic primary for governor this year. And it's a very interesting three-way race. Getting into a lot of that with Jumaane Williams in just one moment. Later in the show, stay tuned for a portion of an interview I just did this morning with the chair and CEO of the MTA, Jana Lieber, talking about where things stand with the MTA, especially related to sort of his big picture vision, but also granular details around getting more riders back to the system here in the COVID, post-COVID world when there's a lot of work from home and a lot of patterns have changed, what the MTA is doing about that, how he's thinking about its budget issues that are going to become more pressing as federal aid runs out, and a lot of other issues discussed with Jana Lieber at an event this morning hosted by Citizens Union and Citizens Union Foundation, and playing a portion of that interview here later in the show. A lot of really interesting thoughts from Jana Lieber. But first, Jumaane Williams.
Public Advocate Williams, I appreciate you coming back to the show to talk about the final days of the race here.
Thanks so much. Always a pleasure to be on. Extra special to be on as we're closing out this race. So thank you.
Thanks for the time. Appreciate it. So we're here Wednesday, June 22nd, a few more days of early voting through Sunday. Then you got primary day on Tuesday, no voting on the Monday as the Board of Elections sort of resets from the early voting sites to the regular sites. What's the state of the race from where you see it? You are obviously have been far behind in fundraising from a sitting governor, not a huge surprise there. Being governor of New York State usually leads to quite a windfall in the campaign coffers. Polling has showed the Governor Hochul with a sizable lead. But what are you seeing? How are you seeing this on the ground? What are you thinking the state of the race is right now?
I think everything you said is true. And we usually in this situation where we're either outraised, outpolled, sometimes both. We saw that in the lieutenant governor's race. We saw that in the public advocate's race, actually. People don't realize just about 4 weeks before, polls had us about maybe fifth. And so from the first race I ran against an incumbent when I was told I was crazy, I had no shot, to the last race I ran to this one, we seem to be always outnumbered, always outgunned, and things turn out all right on election day. And we know that our voters don't usually show up on the polls. We're usually speaking up and standing up for working, middle, struggling New York class New Yorkers. So it's harder for them to give as much money as the people who are trying to buy policy. But in the end, our message usually works pretty well. So really excited. We've been in the street today already, and the reception has been really good from Brooklyn to Buffalo.
Mm-hmm. And so what is the closing argument here? You're in the final days. You've obviously had a couple of televised debates. You've been making both this combination of your criticisms of Governor Hochul and your, you know, outlining of your vision and your platform. But what is the closing argument here as you're, you know, talking with voters? You get 2 minutes at a subway stop, or you get, you know, a couple of minutes at a microphone at an event. How are you, you know, how's your message sort of crafted in the final days here? What's that message look like?
I mean, the primary message has always been, folks can feel that we lost 70,000 New Yorkers, and we keep hearing leaders like the governor saying we have to return to normal. And then I say to them, normal hasn't really worked for us. And they understand that. And they understand that we want to normalize our lives, but the normal of before is what helped get us here. And that resonates very well. Three pillars of public safety, housing, and the economy are issues that everybody's concerned about all over this state. And the reason we're still worried about that is the status quo politics of Albany has not worked for us. And we represent the best opportunity to change that. And I got to tell you, though, that message is pretty receptive to people who are actually facing foreclosure, facing eviction, trying to purchase food, worried about their job, worried about safety. So that message actually is resonating with folks.
Give us one thing you want people to know on each of those three categories that you would do as governor: housing, public safety, economy. I know it's obviously not always easy to boil things down. You have fairly extensive campaign platform on your website. People can look at that. But people listening to this discussion, people who want sort of a top line pledge from you, what's a top line on each of those that you're pledging to do if elected governor?
Well, I am very proud of the work that we've done on public safety, of reminding folks that from 2012, when we saw an increase of gun violence, to 2018, I was a leading voice in helping us decrease that violence. And we were able to do that while decreasing some of the over-policing that was going on. So been a leader there, and we'd love to do that statewide. But a great, clear vision of difference here is in the public safety realm, we asked for $1 billion to be put set aside for gun violence prevention, youth services, and victim services, the kind of work we did to help us get to where we were pre-pandemic. We didn't get it. What we got was $1 billion for a stadium in Buffalo. And that right there really shows, I'm sorry, not in Buffalo, outside of Buffalo. It's not even in the city that needs the most help. That right there shows you a huge difference. And housing, you know, outside of not having any voucher money for housing or any real foreclosure prevention plan or not supporting good cause eviction. You know, the governor's plan right now is to build and preserve 100,000 units of affordable housing. That's not enough for one of the boroughs in New York City, much less the entirety of the state of New York. And the 20 million people, 220 facing eviction, 90,000 who are homeless, not to count the people facing foreclosure and who are in overcrowded homes right now. We have a plan to build and preserve 1 million units. It's very real. We're happy to explain it. And no one pays more than 30% of their income in rent. That's a huge difference right there on the economy. When the governor says to a room full of millionaires and billionaires, we're not going to raise any of your taxes. We want you to return to New York. And then next week raises $20 million from them. And we're saying, if you're not making $1 million or more, and mostly actually $1 billion after you've paid all of your bills, then anything we're talking about doesn't apply to you. And that's important because the way she phrased it is a Republican talking point meant to protect wealthy donors at the expense of the rest of us. And so we're saying if we want everyone to have housing and health care, we want to lower taxes, property taxes in particular for middle and working class, we're going to have to raise that revenue, especially if we're going to run out of federal funds. And you have to raise it off the people who made more money during this pandemic than the folks who don't. And we're not losing millionaires and billionaires. We're only losing the people who can't afford to stay in New York. And so I think those right there just give you some clear differences in our vision and the current governor's vision.
Explain the housing plan a little bit more. What are the key pieces of that? There's, and I'm also wondering, you know, looking at your housing plan, there is discussion about how, you know, New York needs a lot more housing. I think the conversation around the sort of lack of adequate supply of housing has shifted a little bit in recent months and years as we get more and more data showing, you know, this incredibly low vacancy rate in the city for apartments renting at $1,500 a month or lower, as we see just the numbers in terms of per capita housing development in New York City and the suburbs just trailing so significantly other places around the country. You know, it seems like the conversation shifted a bit, especially among some, not all, progressives like yourself who, you know, seem to be talking, you know, fairly holistically about approaching the housing supply issue, acknowledging that, you know, that the city and the suburbs, although those can be separate conversations sometimes, need to see a lot more housing growth. So what are the key principles of your housing plan, the key mechanisms to make it happen? And how are you thinking about increasing housing supply by, you know, a variety of tools, including, you know, letting the private sector sort of do more, maybe through, you know, zoning changes.
You know, we now live in this city and in this state through this city has the highest rental market in the entire nation. It used to be San Francisco. We've surpassed it. That's how bad it is. And we could talk about the Rent Guidelines Board and the mess they just created yesterday. But our plan, And the state, it hasn't had any real housing built that the state was really a big part of and owning since Mitchell Lama. They haven't really invested in that type of building since Mitchell Lama. We're saying we should build and preserve 1 million units. No one pays over 30% of their income in rent. That means if you make 100,000, you pay 30%. If I make 20,000, I pay 30%. The difference there, the higher and lower, can help cross-subsidize to make sure that the building can operate, because you do need a minimum amount of money for building to operate. And here's where you can use subsidies. Instead of 421A, which was being used to subsidize market rate housing, you can use subsidies for the type of buildings I'm talking about, because not every building will have the amount of money it needs, because we want to do this by lottery. And if everybody applies to ESD, to the urban development that they already exist. And if you build good housing, everybody's going to apply to it. So there are going to be some buildings that need a little bit more assistance to maintain than others. And that's where you use the taxpayer subsidies, not 421A and other subsidies that don't really get to the heart of it, but to a building like this, a project like this. And it's very sustainable. It's very doable. Now, I'll ask three questions to you and people who are listening right now. You can play at home. But the first question is usually, who believes that housing and homelessness is some of the biggest issues we have in the state? Proverbially raise your hand. You have to talk about housing and homelessness together. Sometimes people talk about it separately. And then everybody raises their hand. Who thinks that the answer to most of the housing issues is housing that people can afford, whether it's supportive or not? Most people raise their hand. Who wants a taller or denser building next to them? Anywhere you go across the state, the answer to those three questions are usually the same. Yes, yes, and no. And so we generally know what the answer is, but we have to do more to get to it. And what happens is that our leaders sometimes try to force people into what it should be, when we really should just have a conversation with folks. And you talk to people, say, look, we have to give up some density in certain places. Where is it that you want us to preserve right now? And where can you give up a little bit more? And if you have that conversation, I think you'd be surprised, because I think people will understand, if we look the way we did 100 years ago, we would have failed our current population. If we look the way we do 100 years from now, we would have failed them. That doesn't mean you want to change where you live overnight. And so you have to have this conversation in a way that respects that everybody's going to answer those three questions the same, but push them to say, okay, we're going to preserve this area. We're going to give it some density, because we have to build and we have to preserve truly affordable housing for us to get out of this crisis.
And you're saying, in order to pay for some of what you want to do here, you're looking at, as you mentioned, revenue raising tax increases on the highest earning New Yorkers. Obviously, we've seen taxes increased in recent years. There was a tax increase on those very New Yorkers passed 2 years ago. We haven't seen significant data showing wealthy earners, you know, fleeing the state. But there's got to be a point where that balance could really be tipped, don't you think?
So one, some of this housing right now, if we just thankfully we stopped this 421A program that was costing $2 billion a year and getting us mostly market rate housing, that money can be repurposed to ESD and the New York State Urban Development Corporation right now to reformat the projects that they are already involved in to do what Liz was saying. Secondly, we have to have a civically responsible conversation with wealthy people. Everybody has to do what they can with what they have where they are. As you mentioned, the state's own budget director, after the governor made that misinformed comment, I don't know if it was misinformed or maybe willfully and misinformed comment, said that we're not losing these folks. We may have lost one. He has orange hair. He lives in Mar-a-Lago, and he can stay there. But the rest of the folks who are leaving are people who cannot afford to live in this city. So we have to be concerned about both of those. There's, for some reason, always this question about what about the most wealthy who actually are doing well. And so it's not a conversation at this point about we want to penalize you for success. It's about, we have to have this discussion or New York State will continue to fail. And if we don't know the intersection, understand the intersection of people having housing, having healthcare, and what that means to public safety, we may never understand it better than we do right at this moment in time. And we don't have a choice, because even some of the good things that were in this budget, people don't know they're listed out in what we call the out years, 4, 5, 6, 7 years down the line. And when we lose that one shot money from the federal government, we're going to start cutting those as well. And what happens to the New Yorkers who need the most assistance, and the New Yorkers who are middle class, who are struggling, who are working? If there's one group that can have a second home on Park Avenue and not pay any taxes on it, and there's another group who are literally homeless on the brink of homelessness, that just can't be allowed to exist.
What did you think of Governor Hochul had in her original policy platform? Some policies for accessory dwelling units, allowing those in all areas zoned for single family housing, and then a push for more transit oriented development. Those got a lot of pushback, especially from Long Island elected officials, including one of your competitors in this race, Tom Suozzi, among others, although he's spoken favorably about some of these policies, but saying he wants to do them more localized. So she dropped those. Are those two things that you would pursue? Are there any other sort of policies like those that are in your housing plan as well? But what about those two things specifically?
I think you have to pursue them. The way it was done just tells me that, unfortunately, as in most things, we're more interested in trying to ensure that we get a group of voters to win an election than to actually help New Yorkers. And that's a problem. And we see that in the Republican Party in this most acute manner. We're literally allowing people to be massacred by machine guns because people want to make sure they get reelected. Unfortunately, the Democratic Party does the same thing. I don't want us to jump out of the frying pan into the fire, but we have to acknowledge some of the things that we do. And that's one of them. Now, this is a conversation that should have been had with those people who have the concerns that you've spoken about. But we have to push through them because we can't do this without the additional housing. And what we do know, and I've seen in the past, is when there's pushback on housing, and particularly income target affordable housing, it usually has a discriminatory effect. And we just have to be aware of that. Again, we have to do here and protect here. And so we should have a conversation. Where is it and what else can we protect if we build up this these units of housing? And then we have to make sure that we make them affordable as well. We obviously have to build up, in transit area, which I think is what you said. We want to make sure that occurs again, but it doesn't go crazy. Like everybody doesn't want to become Manhattan. And we have to make sure that happens, that doesn't happen when we do this. We also have to make sure that when we do build up in transit rich areas, that we don't push out people who are already there. We make sure that affordability remains.
We could talk housing for hours. I'll have to stop there because I want to touch on some other things, although I have a lot more I want to get your perspective on there. But we'll talk housing down the line at some point a bit more. On answers to gun violence, on bail reform, on criminal justice matters, policing, public safety, the mayoral election, public polling, other pieces of data out there seem to indicate that you and others who offer your perspective are just not winning the public battle. How are you thinking about these things and what's gone wrong for Democrats and especially progressive Democrats in making this case? And how are you making it in this primary to try to win over people that are skeptical that your answers, for lack of a better term, are just sort of too far, towards the left progressive vision?
So there's a lot there. We always have to unpack, what the word progressive means and doesn't mean. It's weaponized right now. The left is weaponized, but then you still have leaders trying to say they'll tell you themselves, this is why I'm progressive. So the word actually means something that people want to say they are, which means people are safe, they have housing, they're not saddled with debt, and they can get health care. And everybody agrees with that. What happens is when you try to make it happen, are you going to have the political courage to do it and push past the leadership that may be pushing on you? I think that's where the dividing line really is. I would push back and say that I think some of what you're saying is correct, but you look at, I think you mentioned the mayoral election. That same election where the mayor elected me, elected the comptroller, elected the board president, elected a lot of city council members that had the message that you were saying. And so I think the electorate is intelligent and understands what's happening and stands the points of view. There are many people who were elected that have the vision I think you're saying and speaking about when you say the words progressive and left.
Just to be clear, I'm talking about, moving some funding away from law enforcement into community solutions. As you said, you wanted to see $1 billion in the state budget for those types of, violence interrupter programs, community resources, really targeted at getting at root causes of crime and gun violence, you know, those types of things.
So what's interesting, though, if you ask, people who are sold a bill of goods around Obamacare, do you want Obamacare? And they would tell you no. I hate it. And then you ask them, do you want to keep the Affordable Care Act, the affordable health insurance you have? They would say yes, not realizing the same thing. And so if you ask people, should we defund the police? They'll say no. If you ask them, should we move some of the money that goes to police for mental health response to the Department of Mental Health and Hygiene? They would say yes. And so we have allowed people to weaponize certain things. And that is more about an election, again, than actually helping people. And so we focused on that word defund, which is so frustrating to me because I knew it wasn't the best thing to use. But I kept telling folks, our job is not to tell people in the street in pain how to express their pain. Our job is to take that pain and turn it into policy and work up with solutions. Democrats are terrible when it comes to talking about public safety. Horrible. And so when they do it and they can't do it, they go to Republican-like talking points. Republicans are better at their own talking points. The issue around, public safety, if you look at those same polls, 66,000 New Yorkers were asked, what should we do about public safety? They said housing, mental health, and third was responsible policing. You looked at people who said, should we have, some additional police in the subway and some other places? Most folks said yes. Yeah, they asked, do you think you have enough police in your community? They said yes. And so a lot of this polling will show you that people want to be safe. And if you presented them safety as simply policing, they will say yes. But if you extend that conversation out and say, do you want public safety, which means everybody has the things that they need to make a community safe, they will also say yes. And so I just keep saying, well, just don't stop at the police question, because why do every community that you ask about police, which many do say they want that service, and they should get that service. They should get the transparency and accountability. The taxpayers are paying for that. And I've always uplifted that as something that is needed as a partnership in public safety. The question is, what happens to the rest of the things those communities have asked for, like income-targeted affordable housing, like schools that have sports programs and guidance counselors in it, like more than just potato chips to feed your children, like the ability to go to a hospital and get good health care, like the community groups that have been working on the ground fighting for eight-hour shifts, but 24 hours a day, people are getting shot. Those things are valid as well. We just don't have a structure or the proper funding for them. So people keep doing this. You have to run to your corners. And where we've been successful is telling people that we want you to be safe and feel safe. And when you break down what that actually means, almost everybody agrees with it. The problem that many people have is in the debates, you answer a 60-second question. You can't answer public safety in 60 seconds. And so we revert to, this is either police or not police, and that's not the case. You focus on bail reform, although the governor's own words, I tell people to read her own words and her own op-ed. It said that bail reform is working. We can't blame the rise in crime to bail reform. And if we change it, we're not going to see a drop. But we're going to do it anyway. And that's what happened in the 94 crime bill that people apologized for 30 years later. Dangerousness is already considered in 49 other states, and they have cities that are more dangerous and more violent than us. And if you're a victim of crime, you don't care anything about what's happening in those other places. All you care about is what's happening to you and your family. But we have to have leaders that can understand and put some context into it so that we can put a plan that actually gets people to be safe, like we did with the leadership I'm proud to have been a part of in 2018 and 2019. And we sounded the alarm that this was about to get worse, and nobody listened. And it's a frustrating thing to hear, because as I've always mentioned, this is not theoretical to me. This is things I've been dealing with for a very long time.
As you said, Democrats really struggle talking about public safety. The bail reform conversation seems to be a really good example of that. There was really nobody at the state level out there defending it as it was, coming under lots and lots of attack. The question around, defund, as you mentioned, defund the police, you seem to be much better at talking about these issues. But at the same time, there seem to be, some challenges with overcoming that deficit in convincing people in the messaging. Like I said, you know, some of what the polling shows, I hear what you're saying in terms of how you phrase the questions can matter to how people respond to them. But, you know, whether it's, again, you know, the message that Mayor Adams won on, whether it's the apparent leads in the polls that Governor Hochul's had, and some of the other ways that we, you know, sort of gauge public opinion, is some of this, does some of this just come back to money in terms of you being able to get your message out more? You know, what do you feel like? I understand you said at the beginning of the conversation, you know, you think things are resonating more than polls might show. You've been in these positions in the past and overperformed what some of the numbers have said. But, you know, in order to get your message out on, especially on public safety, but also on housing and other issues, is that the biggest impediment? You know, I look, the other thing I'd add to the question, though, is, you know, I look sort of at your website, I look at your ads. You know, maybe slogans are overrated, but, you know, I don't know that I see, you know, something from you in this campaign that's really, you know, sort of defining your vision for people in a very clear, succinct way. Is that a fair question?
Well, just again to back up, because Eric Adams was elected at the same time as Jumaane Williams, Brad Lander, and Tony Reynoso, and a whole new slew of council members. And so people forget that part. There was a message that was sent. I don't think the message was one-sided at all. And people all across the state were elected on this message. You know, we're doing a lot of good work in Buffalo and Rochester. Rochester elected city council members that were even further left than some of the things that we're saying. So this message is resonating if people have the courage to actually have the conversations. The conversations take time. And I think people don't want to take that time. They just want to give quick answers. And I guess we're going into July, and I think people are seeing that there aren't the quick answers that people want. There are answers that we can start with day one and day two, and we should do those things. And the quicker we do those things, the safer people will be and the safer people will feel, because those two things are sometimes different, and we have trouble addressing both of those. In 2018, 2019, we were safer than we'd ever been, and people still didn't feel safe. And so we have to really address those things, but we have to help New Yorkers walk through our plan and what that plan is. And the subway is a great example. We said at the first surge last year that if we only send police, we're not going to be able to solve the issues there. I think we're going on to the fourth or fifth surge, and we're still not. Money is definitely a big part of it. You know, when you outspend that much, you can't say that money is not a part of it. What we do know is when people hear the message, they actually tend to gravitate toward it. And that's what we've seen in every one of our races, even in the ones that we've lost. And so when you have people who want to buy policy and they know that your policy can't be bought, if it's not beneficial to the people, it's not going to happen. That's harder to do. But what we will continue to do is push this message. I do think when people take the time to listen to our message and we can speak to them, they respond. And the only difference is how many people we can speak to at any given time. Sometimes is money. But, you know, in 2018, we hopped in my car, drove around the state, talked to many people as we could. And we had, a very good result. I don't see we'll have anything different this time. Hopefully, the only difference will be in this plurality, we'll come away winning.
Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez endorsed today your running mate, the candidate for Lieutenant Governor Ana Maria Archila, who you're running separately in the primaries, but you know, running together as a slate. You know, this gets back to sort of the question around some of the momentum, even the grassroots fundraising. Why no endorsement for you from AOC? And what about, you know, just that as indicative of whether this has sort of been able to capture the progressive movement as a movement campaign that people are really focused on?
Well, you know, first, run Ana Maria, run. We're running as a ticket, so we want to make sure that we are both winning. I would say we actually both have endorsements that each other does not have, but all of the endorsements really lift up the vision that we both are running on. And so it's beneficial, I think, to the both of us, any of those endorsements that one has and the other doesn't. For the both of us, I think you'll find there won't be too many people voting for one and not the other. So I do think it's helpful all the way around. Mm.
Are you in conversations with Representative Ocasio-Cortez about backing your campaign, or is that not happening? Given you didn't do a joint thing with you and Ana Maria Archila as a ticket.
I mean, I stay in conversations with the Congress member, her team, with other folks who've endorsed and haven't. I think Ana Maria stays in conversation with people on our side who've endorsed us and haven't endorsed her. So the conversations are ongoing. But like I said, the momentum for anybody who's endorsed one of us actually helps both of us. So that part is exciting.
This reminds me a little bit of stuff, you had an assessment of the mayoral race around, sort of people not really coming around Maya Wiley last year until very late. And there was a lot of, it was obviously a different field. There were people who endorsed Scott Stringer and then left him after sexual misconduct allegations. And, Diane Morales was in the mix and so forth. But, you had a critique. I remember us discussing after the mayoral election where you endorsed Maya Wiley that, the left really just didn't really get it together behind her early enough and strong enough. And that really held things back. Is that kind of happening again here?
So what I would say is I think there's always has to be a postmortem after every election. There'll definitely be a postmortem after this election. But we are excited about what we're feeling on the ground. And we're going to go into this election very strong. I think what you'll see nationally, though, is people are tired of elected officials. I think they're tired of politics. I think you see that all across the country. You turn on TV and it looks like things aren't working. Even now, even as the governor has spent how many millions of dollars, many people don't even know there's an election going on. And so I don't think we have done a good job keeping people informed. And I think people are tired. They're tired of fighting Trump. They're tired of fighting to push Biden to do the right thing. And so we're dealing with some of that. But I will tell you, just going around and speaking to folks in train stations and supermarkets and on the street, it's exciting. I went to Buffalo. I gotta tell you, the reception there was even better than I might have hoped for. So really excited about this. We'll have a postmortem, and the postmortem is due, just like I did with the mayoral. Right now, we're gonna build on the excitement that's on the ground for both myself and Ana Maria. And we both bring different things to the table that help both of us, and we're excited about that.
And we have to leave it there with Jermoni Williams, the New York City public advocate and a Democratic candidate for governor in the election that's happening right now. Early voting is happening, absentee balloting is happening, and primary day is coming up Tuesday, June 28th. You are listening to Max Politics here on WBAI Radio, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org. This has been Max from Gotham Gazette. Really interesting conversation there with Jermoni Williams as he is seeking to come out victorious in this Democratic primary for governor that's happening right now, despite his major disadvantages, especially in fundraising to Governor Hochul and even to Congressman Tom Suozzi, the two other candidates in the Democratic primary for governor. Heard some hopeful thoughts there from Jermoni Williams, but also some realistic thoughts about some of the signs that point to the possibility of him not pulling it out. Anyway, there was a bit more to the conversation. You can find the full thing at Max Politics, wherever you find your podcast, or the Gotham Gazette website. We'll have the whole thing at both those places. Now, here's a portion of my conversation from earlier today with MTA CEO and chair of the board, Jano Lieber.
Let's zoom way out first. Last summer, change in the governor's office. Yeah. You're acting MTA chair and CEO. Right. Governor Hochul's coming in. She's making a lot of personnel decisions. Did you have to make your case to her to keep you and nominate you? And if so, what did that sound like? What is the sort of big picture Jano Lieber leadership of the MTA vision that you would pitch to a governor or anybody else who you're approaching as a steward and investor in the MTA?
How about last man standing? mean, seriously, this is an easy conversation. Governor Hochul and I knew each other a little bit because she had obviously represented the state in a lot of different, you know, ceremonial settings and events and so on. So we knew each other a little. And it was a very quick, you know, positive building teamwork. I just briefed her on what we were in the middle of, how we were getting through COVID, what the major, you know, issues and challenges were, and we kind of got to work. But she assured me very early on that, you know, I was going to have a little less, direction from Albany than
interference, I'll say.
Yeah, and then might have otherwise been the case. But it was quick, it was easy. I've known, you know, members of her team, many of them for many years, so it was kind of a smooth transition. And she has been great. I mean, she supported us in everything that we are doing from, you know, from the get-go. So it really has not been complicated. And she had put forward a really aggressive program in her budget. I just want to call out, everything gets lost in the sauce when, you know, so much happening in the legislative session, but we were only able to keep the fare at the same level because the governor's budget included hundreds of millions of dollars for MTA operating. Now, with the way that the financing of the MTA has developed, with ridership coming back a little more slowly than had been expected in the previous projections, we're redoing that. And that's why I'm saying that I need Albany to focus on that issue anew, maybe next year.
Let's come back to that in a second. So if you're leading the MTA for another 5 years, 10 years, what do you want the Jana Lieber legacy to be? Is it that it's a world-class transit system that is really on the level of cities around the world that have mostly over, you know, decades outpaced us, or what is it?
Okay, first of all, I'm absolutely not conceding that we're way behind the rest of the world. I mean, if you compare not just the caliber and frequency of service and the breadth of the system in terms of what it covers, the numbers of stations, we have so many more stations than peers. We cover so much more territory. We have so many more rail cars. And we have a fare that's really affordable. Everybody fetches about the fare. We're all New Yorkers, right? But $2.75 compared to what it costs in London. $1.37 if you're over a certain age. I talked to a couple folks here this morning about it. That is a great value. It is one of the things that makes New York affordable. New York is expensive in so many ways, but for a lot of people, the fact that you don't have to own an automobile at $10,000+ a year is really a huge affordability positive. And I'm very proud of the fact that our system is, you know, part of that affordability calculus for lots of folks. So, you know, I don't think our system is less than world class. Listen, it's old. It needs a ton of investment. But if we bring it into a state of good repair, we have, you know, frequent and reliable service. If it is, and continue to make some of these investments, signaling, ADA accessibility, transition to a zero emissions bus fleet, in addition to being an accessible bus fleet, and the big projects, which are equity projects that include lots of people who are outside the mass transit system's footprint right now, Second Avenue Subway. I mean, Citizens Union is an old organization, so you probably have some debates from the time when they tore down the Second and Third Avenue L and promised a Second Avenue Subway in the 40s. In the 1940s, that's how long those people in that, you know, economically disadvantaged part of New York have been promised a subway. That project that I mentioned in the East Bronx, those people are off the subway and the commuter rail grid. So, you know, if we get those things done, and God willing, fix Penn Station, which is one of my personal life goals, I think we'll have a lot to be proud of.
And also on the list of mega projects is much earlier in development, the Interborough Express, which would be, depending on what it winds up looking like, something of a major extension of rail service in New York City. Is there another big pet project of your own that is is not yet on the list that you would love to do, or is more subway extension anywhere on your agenda? You know, big picture here, and then we'll come
to some of these. Yeah, listen, the way we're doing capital program planning at the MTA now, I think, is much more scientific and substantive. What we're doing is we're analyzing the whole system using what they call EAM, Enterprise Asset Management, to see what parts of the system need investment most urgently, which are most critical to service. But we also, that's for the existing system, but we also are evaluating neutrally the big projects that are candidates. And we all hear about them. I mean, there are projects on Long Island where people are passionate, they want to have their line electrified. There's just all kinds of ideas about big projects. So we're doing that in a more neutral way. So the ones that we have on the board that are we know are coming are, you know, fixing existing PENN. Moynihan is great. We love our Amtrak friends. State of New York bought them a new home. They left us in charge of the old home, which is dumb. And we need to fix it for New Yorkers, because that New Yorkers aren't going to a new expansion of PENN, and they're not going to Moynihan. They're stuck in existing Penn Station, so we got to fix that. The Interborough Express is interesting, not just because it extends the reach of the subway system, but it connects a lot of people who are not on subways to the whole system by going north-south, and most of the lines go east-west to Manhattan. And it deals with the new patterns of travel, which include much more Brooklyn to Queens trips. There are more people who work in Brooklyn and Queens and go inside between those boroughs than there are people who travel across the East River Manhattan. Who would have thought that? We got to deal with that pattern of travel, and that's why the governor's Interborough Express idea, which uses an existing rail line, which is sitting there almost untouched, is a great idea.
That project, knowing that's on the board, is subway extension in Queens, in Brooklyn, on your agenda in any way?
Yeah, I mean, there's some other good ideas. I mean, people have been talking about Utica Avenue for a while. You know, I would say, broadly speaking, we're going to analyze these projects neutrally, but part of it has to be connected to our vision collectively for how do we develop the city. You know, the biggest threat to New York, in my view, is not, you know, I'm optimistic about safety, maybe because I grew up in the 70s and 80s and saw, you know, our murder rate go down by 85%. So I believe that, you know, New York is on a good trajectory. The biggest threat, I think, is like our lack of housing production. So I think we need to combine thinking about transit investments with where do we want to build? Where are we going to build housing and densify a little bit? So, you know, in fairness, I don't think it makes sense for the MTA to start building subway lines unless the land use authorities are also willing to say we're going to build along those corridors. That's the connection that has to be, I think, thought through.
You noted that ridership has returned to a significant degree, but still roughly 40% shy of pre-pandemic levels. Do you have numeric targets? Do you have goals for getting ridership back? You're at 60% now on the subways. Do you want to get to 80% by a certain date or by the turn of the year? Are you hoping to be at a certain place? There's some talk that more business leaders will be asking people to come back to the offices a little bit more in September after summer vacations and so forth. Any targets?
I mean, which of us doesn't have a crystal ball and which of us has the right one? I mean, we've all been learning as we go with COVID. Look, we're reprojecting. Like, my crystal ball doesn't matter. We're doing a reprojection with a McKinsey, which did a pretty good job the first time around for us until Omicron hit, and then we sort of saw things starting to flatten out. We're doing an update. We're going to use that for our planning purposes. It's probably going to show that what we hoped we were going to be back in the 80% range by the end of this year, we're hoping to be back more in the 70s, right? That's where our aspirations realistically are. But, you know, the bottom line is it's not so terrible if the Lexington Avenue subway at 8 a.m. doesn't mean you have to have a full-on body encounter with other New Yorkers, right? So you got to have, we got to look at the plus side. Every other city in the nation, we did their IT for a little extra capacity like we have right now. This isn't a terrible thing as long as we can finance it. and provide service that lets New York, in the maybe post-COVID era, come back together. It's not the end of the world.
All right, so in your introductory remarks, we need a new financial plan, and Albany has to get us there.
Yep.
That's their responsibility, the governor, the state legislature. They need to figure out MTA financing, or are you going to be offering a plan and ideas?
It's sort of, the word of the day is hybrid, right? So a little bit of a hybrid. I think what our job is to start, you know, to help start the conversation and to inform it with data. Seed ideas and bring some people together who are smart and have been through this and have the expertise to look at this different options. So we're going to do that. But at the end of the day, the MTA has to be agnostic about, you know, let the legislative process play out. And that's, so we're going to try to, you know, help the discussion along, make sure that after the election, you know, that folks who have to take up the cudgels in Albany for the new session have some ideas to work with.
Nobody's going to want to raise taxes in Albany for purposes of bringing the MTA under what you call essential service. What do you see as the possibilities there?
Yeah, like I said, I'm not going to be directing or even owning any particular ideas. Look, the capital program, I mentioned the capital program that we've got right now, which is like $55 billion, where the others were before it were in the low $30 billion range. And they did it with a couple of new, you call them taxes, but fees on, you know, that captured some value from internet sales and from the mansion tax. Nobody's, you know, crying in their beer about the internet sales tax and mansion tax. And they did it with congestion pricing, so there was some good policy supporting it as well. So I'm confident that when folks start to dialogue about this, new ideas will emerge, and that they are ones that, you know, won't impede the state's economic research.
And at some point, you're going to have to resume the fare increases that were.
Yeah, I mean, Dick Ravitch and the folks who looked at the big problem in the financial crisis era, like more than 10 years ago, came up with the idea that what we should be doing is having, you know, regular, moderately sized fare increases that basically try to keep up with inflation. We were doing that for years and years. And, you know, I think that hopefully we were able to get back on that path. But right now, we need to get everybody back. And so, as the governor said, fare increase is not the right time for fare increase.
Any sense when that might start again?
No, but, you know, it's going to be part of any financial plan to set that path going forward.
When you think about pulling people back, keep the fare where it's at, you talked about service, reliability.
Yep.
What's happening to rethink some of that, including rethinking some of the patterns, the ways people are getting around the city, that they're using more off-peak transit, more weekend ridership? How are you addressing those changes and insisting on some new performance?
Well, I mean, the basics of, you know, figuring out how do we have a more reliable system are the same. And Rich Davey is the guy who's just come on board to lead us, who's a really experienced transit professional who rose up through the ranks in Boston to be actually secretary with oversight over the Airport Authority and the state DOT, as well as mass transit. So Rich is starting to dig in to you know, those questions of how to have you know, more reliable service. And, you know, we have the ability to sort of increase speeds, and part of it is, I mean, without getting too technical, and to reduce, you know, sort of the inefficiencies of the system, of how we turn around trains, how we crew them, what is our process. I mean, it's what you're talking about, 30 seconds, a minute, you know, 20 seconds. There are a lot of ingredients to doing better with that. But the other piece of your question is about just, you know, how do we do a better job on nights and weekends? Because what we see is that people are riding more. It's a great sign that when people want to go somewhere, they don't have to go to the office, but when they want to go somewhere, they're using mass transit. They're using it more frequently than they are just for commuting time. So we want to encourage that. And that means looking at how do we provide really reliable service nights and weekends, even as we're trying to get all that capital work done.
And we have to leave it there with Jan Oliber, the chair and CEO of the MTA, discussing a number of issues related to the city's subways and buses, its mega projects, and a whole lot more. And of course, the MTA also responsible for the commuter rails and regional rail lines, the Long Island Railroad, Metro North. A lot of interesting thoughts there from Jan Oliber. That was only a small portion of the conversation. You can find the full discussion at Max Politics, wherever you get your podcast, or the Gotham Gazette site. That conversation was actually part of an event hosted earlier today by Citizens Union and Citizens Union Foundation, where I was able to interview Jan Oliber in front of a small crowd. Really good discussion. Again, a lot more to it. Went on for a good 45 minutes or so. You are listening to Max Politics here on WBAI Radio, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org. Two really interesting conversations this week with Jemani Williams about his campaign for governor and with Jan Oliber about his leadership of the MTA. Thanks very much for listening and tuning in. Don't forget to vote, and we will talk with you soon.
The original Constitution was vague about family rights and the right to control one's body. That was to protect slavery.
Law professor Peggy Cooper Davis, arguing that constitutional amendments passed after the Civil War in order to guarantee freedom to formerly enslaved people also enshrined reproductive rights. Join the Joy of Resistance for an extended conversation with Professor Davis on Thursday, June 23rd at 11 a.m. We'll also speak with Carrie N. Baker about a letter to President Biden signed by 25 senators urging an immediate executive order to protect abortion should Roe v. Wade be overturned next week. That's Thursday, 11 a.m., Joy of Resistance, always on the cutting edge of women's rights around the world.
The previous program was Max Politics with Ben Max, heard Wednesdays at 5 p.m. here on WBAI New York, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org online. Coming up in the next hour will be the WBAI Evening News with Paul DiRienzo. But before we go there, here's my appeal once again to the listening audience. As you know, by now, the month of June, we're making an attempt of raising some funds for not only the transmitter at Four Times Square, where that device is responsible for broadcasting the signal of WBAI within a 90-mile radius, but also money for the rent where the studios of WBAI are located at 388 Atlantic Avenue. We are 2 months behind the rent for Four Times Square, the transmitter, and 3 months behind the rent here at 388 Atlantic Avenue, which means that we need your help, listening audience, y'all. 212-209-2950 is the number to call to show your financial support to this radio station. 212-209-2950, or go to give to WBAI.org online. I rather not say a word and just keep things moving. I feel that the programs should have its say more often than not, but desperate times needs desperate measures. And when management asked me to pitch during in between times programs, I know that things